President Bush is expected to hold another teleconference with advisors in Iraq this week on the topic of the war. The president insisted in his radio address this past weekend that U.S. troops won't come home before the mission is complete, and the White House downplayed a New York Times report that the Bush administration was getting ready to present the Iraqi government with a blueprint for improving the situation in the country, saying it was merely another new tactic in the war, not a new strategy or change of course. Well, we'll be speaking with two military experts today. First, Colonel Thomas Hammes, who was one of a handful of recently retired senior military leaders who spoke out publicly about the strategy in Iraq and has called for the resignation of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. And Colonel, by the way, you said I can call you TX?
Yes.
Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, as we reported last week, there were talks in Washington over the weekend between lawmakers and military people to take a look at potential new strategies for Iraq. But I want to ask you first about what is actually happening on the ground right now. Today's New York Times reports that U.S. generals there say there is no fallback plan in Iraq beyond the current strategy of trying to pacify Baghdad, the clear, hold, and build strategy, that is, clearing insurgents out, holding the neighborhoods with coalition forces, and building the infrastructure to win hearts and minds. You've been critical in the past of how that plan has been carried out. How so?
Well, primarily, we failed to support it. Clear, hold, build is classic counterinsurgency strategy. The problem is, we do the clear with U.S. forces, and then the hold has to be done with Iraqi forces and done for a long period of time with U.S. force support. We have provided insufficient support to the Iraqi forces. Our training teams are small, only 10 per infantry battalion. They should be about 60, so almost an order of magnitude off. We have failed to provide the Iraqi armed forces with much equipment. They're still riding around in open-back pickup trucks.
Actually, we heard reports over the weekend on 60 Minutes of the $1.4 million that was supposed to go to arming Iraqi forces. $800 million seems to have been lost.
Yes, that's probably true, because one of the things we didn't do is provide advisors in their Ministry of Defense.
So there was no oversight.
Right. We needed to provide an effective number of advisors in the civilian agencies and throughout the military organizations to prevent this, and we have never really seriously provided advisors.
Why do you think that is?
I think, as near as I can tell, the Secretary of Defense just is not focused on the war. He has other priorities. His priority is transformation. He feels that that's how he will be known. This is my understanding. Obviously, I'm not close to him. But there has been no indication that the Pentagon has ever gone on a wartime footing. For instance, today, we have units preparing to go to Iraq that do not have equipment to train on. They're just a couple of months out. They have to go into a war in 2 months. They don't have equipment. Why don't they have equipment? We have not told our depots to work overtime. They're working 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. They're refused overtime because we don't want to spend the money. In my mind, that's immoral.
So just to be clear, is the strategy right now itself wrong, or is it just the way it's being implemented?
The strategy is right for an insurgency. It is not being implemented properly. We are rapidly slipping out of insurgency into civil war. That creates a different problem, but I think a similar solution, which is the strengthening of the Iraqi government and its armed forces and security forces, which is what we are failing to do and have failed to do since day one. We have never provided sufficient resources to their security forces.
Well, as we know, there are other things being discussed in Washington, even though the Bush administration denies that there will be a change in strategy. But some of the discussions apparently entail the idea of splitting the country into three separate parts, reducing U.S. troop strength, instituting a military junta, and pretty much also saying goodbye to the idea of democracy, in at least in the way the Bush administration envisioned it. Is there one of those ideas that jumps out at you as a particularly bad or good idea?
Well, first off, we will not decide if they break up, they will. And they seem to be making that decision already with the ethnic cleansing in the neighborhoods, the moving even within Baghdad to get into either pure Shia or Sunni neighborhoods.
In fact, you say there's a template for what we're seeing now in Iraq, and it's in Afghanistan when the Soviets began to pull out?
Not when they began to pull out. When the Afghans figured out they were going to pull out, which is early 88 before they announced it. At that point, the Afghans stopped attacking the Soviets and prepared for the fight with each other and began ambushing each other.
So are you saying that the fact that the U.S. has hinted at pulling troops out over the next several months, which many lawmakers on both sides of the aisle now are calling for, are you saying that, that's actually leading to some more of this ethnic cleansing and some more of the sectarian fighting that we're seeing as militias prepare to take hold after the U.S. leaves?
Yes, because put yourself in the place of an Iraqi. If the U.S. pulls out, that government can't stand without U.S. support. So who's going to protect you and your family? And even now, with the government unable to provide protection, you turn to the militia, the tribe, the clan, and that's what they're looking for, is how to protect their families. How are they going to live through the next few days?
So, Colonel Hammers, TX, you've been very critical in the past. You've called for the resignation of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. What do you think should happen now?
Well, we obviously have to make changes. If we're going to stick with our strategy, we have to make changes in the people running that because they're not supporting it. I think Donald Rumsfeld, as being in charge from the beginning, has not recognized the mistakes, and he is not the person to change those mistakes. And he's done tremendous service to the country. At this point, he can do his one more great service and resign. Then whoever takes over has to get serious about supporting the strategy. But what both parties owe us, the Bush administration owes us an explanation of what are the possible outcomes from his stay the course with no changes. And that means an honest evaluation. And in planning, you look at everything from best case to worst case. But what's your best case is this held together Iraq with a democratic government. Okay, what's your worst case? The people who are saying it's time to do a scheduled pullout also owe us the same analysis. For instance, no one's saying either if we pull out and this civil war gets rolling full blast, does it stay within Iraq's borders, or does it become a greater Shia-Sunni civil war? We haven't had a discussion of that. What does it do to the world oil market? What does it do to stability throughout the Middle East?
Recently retired Marine Colonel Thomas Hammes. He's also author of The Sling and the Stone on War in the 21st Century. Well, we turn now to another former Marine, author Francis Bing West. He served in Vietnam and was Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan. Last month, he returned from his 10th trip to Iraq, where he was embedded with Marines. Bing, welcome.
Thank you.
And first of all, Colonel Hammes just said the militia violence in Iraq, the sectarian violence we're seeing, isn't because the U.S. is there, as some critics are saying, but because there is talk of the U.S. forces leaving, a sort of a scramble for power in advance of a power vacuum. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's, I mean, I like TX, but I think it's very hard from 6,000 miles away to be attributing rationale to people who are killing each other. Unfortunately, the basic fact is that Zarqawi and the terrorists began this campaign against the Shiites to kill them 3 years ago. And this is really a Shiite-Sunni split. But the violence does become that it feeds on itself. And TX is right that the problem we've now gotten to is that everyone is looking for someone to protect them. But where I differ, I don't see this basically as saying what the U.S. can do here, what the U.S. can do there. This is a time that those Iraqi security forces and especially their politicians have to stand up.
Well, and as we've been hearing over the weekend, the security forces didn't get the monies that they should have, and they've been infiltrated with members of the militia. As you know, the Bush administration is offering a new blueprint, which is supposed to have benchmarks for the lawmakers in Iraq to, as you said, stand up to put down the militias by certain times. But it feels as if we've heard this before. I mean, what happens if they don't?
The idea of these milestones, I think by any other name, is basically saying to the people at the top in Iraq, here's your timetable, now step up to it. And I think it's pretty obvious what the alternative is, except that no one's talking about it yet.
Which is what?
And that is that when we say, oh, we haven't done this for them, we haven't done that for them, that's really exaggerating. Their army is coming along pretty well. Their police are a total mess. But we have to make a big distinction between those two. And no one has accused the army of being infiltrated by the militia. So you could the alternative that's lurking in the closet, if you will, is for the army to say we're going to take a stronger role over here if you politicians don't get your act together.
You point to a model for a future of Iraq as being South Korea or Turkey.
South Korea and Turkey aren't bad models.
Because why? Because a military-backed government?
Well, because the military had the force and the strength to say there are limits to insecurity that we are not going to tolerate. But gradually you did see in both countries a decent democratic government come to the fore. It just took a long while to get there by our standards, but it gradually got there.
And in fact, would you, as some are saying, point to or call for the need for a military junta now in the short term?
Oh, absolutely not. I think that the wisest thing that can be done is this word milestones that people are using, where they're going to say, look, Prime Minister Maliki, you have to get this under control, and you know you can if you have the courage to begin to act like a prime minister. And all your ministers should be out there. Let's see some of you show courage and get out on those streets. That's what basically many politicians would do in the West, and that's what I think we should expect of their politicians. They have to be leaders.
You also say another model for the future of Iraq might be our own country after the Civil War, literally just declare one side the victor and the other a loser, which needs more occupation, if you will. Is that what you meant?
Well, that's going a little bit too far, but one has to say, how does a war end? A war doesn't end with everyone saying they're satisfied. At the end of any war, there are some losers and winners. The Sunnis were the losers in that when the democracy was, if you will, declared in Iraq, and everyone was allowed to have one man, one vote, then the Shia came to power, the Shiites, instead of the Sunnis. Now, the Sunnis at some particular point have to accept that they're going to be a minority inside that democratic country. And even at the end of the Civil War, some Union forces occupied the southern part of the United States for another 13 years.
And as we've said on this program, there was insurgency in the form of the KKK for 100 after that. But just a quick question.
Good point, because it takes a long while to change cultural attitudes, a very long while.
But the other difference is that the South wasn't surrounded by neighboring countries with the same religious majorities, meaning the Sunnis in this case, itching to get into the fight again. I mean, is that...
I'd be careful with the word itching, if you will. Mm-hmm. I think that you know, geopolitics is the game, basically, that you play across the border where you have your own internal politics. And I think you see a great deal, really, of restraint on the part of the other countries. Yes, they're meddling, but they're meddling within certain limits. It's still up to the Iraqis. It's not that they're being forced to do this by the Syrians, the Saudis, the Jordanians, the Turks, or the Iranians.
Bing West, got about a minute left. Okay. So you're saying the Iraqis have to stand up?
Absolutely.
Even in that case, how long will U.S. forces be there? By some estimates, there will be at least the need for 50,000 troops for at least 10 years.
I'd be careful of putting 50,000 or something, but I do believe that we have to greatly strengthen the advisory effort while we're withdrawing our combat troops.
Bing West, author, also president of Gamma Corporation, which designs war games and combat decision-making simulations. As you said, he was assistant secretary of defense under President Reagan and has been to Iraq 10 times in recent times. And just in our continuing effort to find out from people with boots on the ground what the future may hold. Bing, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. Moment, we'll continue our look at how midterm election campaigns are playing out, this time in Arizona. But first, looking way ahead to the presidential election of 2008, the Boston Globe is reporting that Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, a rising Republican star and potential presidential candidate, who also happens to be a high-ranking member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, might have reached across the firewall separating church and state, laying out a plan with high-ranking Mormon officials to boost a possible presidential campaign. Joining us with more is Boston Globe political reporter Scott Hellman, who's been covering this story. Scott, welcome.
Good to be with you, Robin.
I understand you found out about this fundraising initiative. It's allegedly called MVP, or Mutual Values and Priorities, when some emails surfaced from a political consultant to Mitt Romney. What's the sum of the thinking of this plan between the church in Salt Lake City and Governor Romney's office?
Well, the plan seems to have been hatched by Romney's advisors, and the idea is, as I understand it, to raise money and build support for Mormons around the country. in some respects, you would expect that to happen with the governor, who is a very prominent member of the Mormon Church and has many friends and supporters. The issue here is that the emails show that there have been discussions among Romney's folks and the church. And as you well know, that gets into a pretty murky area because the IRS very clearly says that religious groups, like any nonprofit, cannot intervene in any campaign on behalf of any candidate.
And this is how they earn their tax-exempt status.
That's exactly right.
Well, now the Mormon Church and Governor Romney's advisors vigorously denied, in particular your earlier reports, Governor Romney saying, as you said, that of course he was going to raise funds from people he knew, the church denying that there had been direct contacts. And at first you didn't quote these emails. Then, as you report, the anonymous person who made them available to you gave you permission to quote from them, so you've since quoted from them. What do the emails say?
The emails, again, are from a consultant to Romney out in Utah, a guy named Don Sterling, who has worked with the governor, known the governor for a long time. And the emails suggest that there have been several discussions with the top church leaders about this plan.
The emails are written to Sherry Du. Who is she?
Sherry Du is the CEO of Deseret Book Company. Deseret Book is a for-profit arm of the Mormon Church, and she is a very, very prominent woman within the Mormon Church. Therefore, Romney's team has been lobbying to get her on board.
In the emails, there are some lines in particular that jump out, one in which names of elders in the church and indeed the church president are mentioned.
That's right. There's one that refers to a guy named Kem Gardner, who is a very prominent Utah developer, one of Romney's biggest donors, who was very close with a guy named Jeffrey Holland, one of the 12 apostles of the Mormon Church, very high up in the leadership. And according to the email, it says here, according to Kem, Elder Holland has been designated / assumed the role of coordinating these matters. Elder Holland surfaced the idea of using the BYU Management Society, which is an alumni group of the business school.
Of Brigham Young University.
Exactly. And its locally based organizations as a starting point to rally and organize the troops on a grassroots level. Elder Holland subsequently surfaced the idea with President Hinckley and Faust, who voiced no objections. Now, President Faust is essentially the number three leader in the church. President Hinckley is the number one leader in the church. So again, what that tells us is that there have been discussions with top leaders of the church here.
Well, Governor Romney's office is saying that this is only an example of Don Sterling, the consultant, overstepping his bounds.
I think that's a pretty hard case for them to make, frankly. It would be one thing if Don were the only one involved in these meetings and discussions. We know Romney's son, one of Romney's sons, Josh, has been at several of these meetings. Again, Kem Gardner is a close friend of his. In fact, one email we have suggests the governor himself was suggesting a very prominent Mormon author and speaker to be part of the discussion. So I think it's pretty hard for them to lay this on Don Sterling.
Well, what are some of the questions being raised? You mentioned the tax-exempt status, not just of the church, but isn't Brigham Young University a nonprofit institution?
That's right. Brigham Young and the church are both considered 501c3 nonprofit organizations, and therefore they cannot engage in any advocacy on behalf of any particular candidate or party. There seem to be sort of three elements to the story. One is the question of whether or not there is some breach of that tax-exempt status. Number two would be the church itself has a very long-standing tradition of what it calls political neutrality. And then the third element here, of course, is the larger political question for Governor Romney. I mean, he's had a great year. A lot of people would tell you right now it's John McCain and Mitt Romney. But there remains deep suspicion about Mormonism and, frankly, a lot of ignorance. And he has to be careful that he explains himself well and that he's not sort of playing into the ignorance and fears of many conservative Christians about Mormonism.
Well, in fact, we know that Mitt Romney has been courting Christian conservatives, speaking, for instance, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, last May, before the Iowa Christian Alliance, trying to overcome that skepticism about the Mormon faith, and especially given that this is the Republican base. And the Salt Lake City Tribune, which has been reporting on your story, quotes political consultant Larry Sabato as saying that there are fears that this alleged move of Mitt Romney's office could have a Manchurian candidate-like backlash, that Romney might be perceived as being a surrogate of the Mormon Church.
The fascinating parallel here, of course, is the 1960 when John Kennedy faced that very question and was asked,
as a Catholic,
exactly, at a time when a lot of America was not terribly excited about electing a Catholic as president. And what John Kennedy did is he got up there and sort of famously said, "I do not answer to the Pope," in a sense saying, I'm the President of the United States. The people are going to be my guide, not the church. And there's been some talk that Romney needs to do the same thing at some point to confront, again, these sort of lingering suspicions. I mean, he has been very careful in front of Christian conservatives to talk about Jesus Christ as his Savior, to sort of talk about the values he shares with other Christians. And I think the more he does that, the more accepting they're going to be of him and his religion.
But it would seem that in light of these emails, he's got a tougher job.
Perhaps. I mean, they deny, of course, that there's any covert coordinated effort between him and the church. But, I mean, as these emails show, clearly there have been some discussions. And as you well know, perception can often be reality, particularly in politics. So he's got to be very careful to nip this in the bud and reassure people that he is not engaged in some kind of, you know, secret campaign with the church.
Boston Globe political reporter Scott Hellman. Scott, thanks so much.
Good to be with you, Rob.
And a quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, if Julia Child brought French cooking to the U.S., then Madhur Jaffrey brought Indian fare. We'll speak with her about food and also about growing up in India during and after partition. That's all tomorrow. Stay with us because we have much more ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from
A little later this half hour, a survivor of Jonestown. But first, we're continuing our look at congressional races around the country. Today, we go to Arizona, where Democrats are hoping to win some seats that have been long in Republican territory. And Gail Shattuck covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor and is today outside the Beltway in Scottsdale, Arizona. Lucky duck. Gail, tell us, you know, first of all, what are the overriding issues there? Immigration's got to be one.
Immigration is the 500-pound monster in this race. It is huge. But what's interesting about it is such a big issue in this state, with so much of the illegal immigration now coming through Arizona since Texas and California have gotten so much stronger on the borders. It's such a powerful issue that both Democrats and Republicans are claiming to be on top of it. So curiously, it may not decide hearts and minds as much in the state as I had expected when I came. It's leaving room for issues like Iraq, corruption, and stem cell research, a huge issue in this state of so many retirees.
So just to
also play a role.
Just to be clear, Gail, because I know you've actually been out where some of the Minutemen are on the border, right?
Yes.
And so this isn't dividing as much Democrats and Republicans as I think I'm hearing you say, as maybe making Arizona feel that it is against Washington, perhaps? Is that?
What's interesting about it is when you talk to people polling the state on the issue, you know, I came thinking that it would be a choice between the approach by John McCain, Arizona Senator, and Ted Kennedy, who wants secure borders but also a path to legalization, and someone like the House Republicans and J.D. Hayworth here in this district who want border first, no path to legalization. A very clear choice. Come to find out, voters in Arizona say yes to all these propositions. They just want something done, clearly. So you have candidates across the board saying that's what they're going to do. But I think the genius of the Democrats in this state, led by Governor Napolitano, is to say that it's the federal government's responsibility to secure borders. It's their fault that things are as bad as they are. And that plays as well in a state that typically has had very mixed views about a strong federal role.
Well, let's take a look at some of the races. You mentioned J.D. Hayworth. And in fact, I think you've just been to a debate in his district, Arizona's 5th.
Just left it.
Oh, good. Okay. Arizona's 5th congressional district. Republican Congressman J.D. Hayworth getting a run for his money from his Democratic opponent, Harry Mitchell, which is surprising to some who may know how strong, you know, a lawmaker J.D. Hayworth has been. So I want to hear about the debate. But first of all, is it that Hayworth has been made vulnerable by issues, or that his opponent, his challenger, Harry Mitchell, is so strong?
I think what it is this tremendous momentum in the country, concern about the war, concern about corruption, concern about a Republican-controlled House, Senate, and White House, concerned even about a scandal involving pages where the Republican leadership didn't respond quickly or effectively enough and looks like they're just comfortable in power. All of these issues are giving Democrats tremendous momentum in a state where they weren't expected to do all that well. I came down thinking I would focus on just the open seat along the border with Randy Graff, a very conservative Republican, original Minuteman, concerned above all about border security. But the longer I stay here, seats like J.D. Hayworth's, traditionally very safe Republican seat, are also now too close to call. And even the first district in the big northwest of the state, with Rick Renzi, that nobody thought was in trouble 3 months ago, is also beginning to look like it might be a close race.
Well, by the way, just sticking with Hayworth for a second, I know that he is running television ads to try to paint his opponent Mitchell as soft on immigration, but Mitchell has been running ads trying to link J.D. Hayworth to former lobbyist Jack Abramoff. And I just wonder, with the debate, did this, you know, how did this give and take go?
Well, I would have to say that nobody debates J.D. Hayworth. I mean, this is someone who is a force of nature. He wraps his arms around the podium and burns conviction. Harry Mitchell, although there's a statue to him in the town of Tempe where he was a very successful mayor, is a much lower key personality, basically read from his notes, and comes across as, you know, having all the right issues in terms of where the momentum is going, but not having the conviction to sell the issues. Now, there aren't that many people that pay attention to debates. It may amount to nothing. The larger momentum for change, concern about the war, worry about stem cell, may be enough to carry even somewhat weaker candidates, on the stump at least, to victory.
J.D. Hayworth, again, a former news commentator and a TV sports broadcaster, so he carries that over in his campaigning. Let's move to other districts. As you mentioned, the Arizona's 8th congressional district seat is open. This was the one that was held by Republican Jim Colby. Not seeking re-election. He, of course, the only openly gay Republican, was linked to the Mark Foley scandal. But he is not running. I'm wondering, though, how much of a carryover of his recent news has affected Republican Randy Graff, who you mentioned is running for that seat, against Democrat Gabrielle Giffords.
Well, this is what's interesting about Arizona. You know, Randy Graff is running almost exclusively on the issue of the border. He was an original Minuteman. I was with him yesterday. He emceed a biker rally down in Benson that ran along the border to basically close off illegal immigrants permanently. They wanted to make a statement, send a message to Washington. They expected about 1,000 bikers. In the end, it was closer to 100. But very intense. These are original Minutemen, strong emotional issues.
In fact, I want to jump in, Gail. You were saying you were at a rally recently for one of the candidates in the 8th, and the candidate was handed a jacket supposedly an illegal immigrant left behind?
This was Randy Graff. Yes, at the beginning, the organizer of the event gave him a motorcycle jacket, or rather a denim jacket, and said this was picked up in the desert, left by an illegal immigrant. He put it on, and then they added, and there's a bullet hole in the back, and everyone laughed. So it's a sense, you know, I don't think it was a serious threat at shooting immigrants, but it's a sign of where the thinking is on this issue, kind of black humor on all sides of it, but also for these folks living right up against the border, seeing wire fences cut and cattle released and refuge all over the place and feeling threatened themselves from globalization, seeing their own jobs and wages threatened, easily linking it to newcomers to the country and the flood of immigration, which you see everywhere here. Yeah. It's an extremely emotional argument. But in this case, it doesn't look like it's going to be enough to sell Randy Graff's candidacy. He's behind in double digits in most of the polls I've seen. As close as he comes, I think it's about 8%. It doesn't look like he'll be able to pull this over because, while immigration is important, every candidate in the state has to say they want to do something about it. It's not the only issue. And corruption, the concern about the war.
Oh, and Iraq
and
is in there
research.
As well.
Exactly.
Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor speaking to us from Arizona, where she's just stepped out of a debate in Scottsdale. We so appreciate it, helping us take a look at races around the country. Gail, we'll check back with you in the next couple weeks. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. went out to Africa, where for some people, listening to the radio is a rare treat. That's because they can't afford the batteries needed to power their sets. So a few years ago, a charitable organization began distributing a different kind of radio. Now the poorest of the poor have a lifeline to the outside world. From Rwanda, Sonia Varma reports.
Okay, let's open up the radios. Now I'm going to demonstrate how to correctly wind the radio.
A half dozen kids crouch on the ground and listen attentively to a visitor. It's not often that a foreigner comes to Niamata, a remote area made up of subsistence farming plots and simple thatched huts. She's handed them new radios, and they clutch them as she explains how they work.
So you turn it strong and fast like that.
The children are the lucky few in this village receiving free solar-powered or wind-up radios. But everyone, from toddlers to the elderly, have come out of their homes hoping for one. Unfortunately, the charity has only a handful to give out. 16-year-old Claudine is one of the recipients. She's an orphan. The Crayola Blue radio will be one of the rare possessions in her hut. I have nothing in my home and no animals, says Claudine. I'm happy to have the radio. I will get up at 5 o'clock and listen to all the radio shows, like Voice of America. Because of the Rwandan genocide in the 1990s and the ongoing ravages of AIDS, there are many orphans here. All the kids receiving the so-called lifeline radios are on their own.
Most are not literate. They have no one to read to them.
Christine Pearson heads the Free Play Foundation, the South African charity donating the no-battery-necessary radios.
So who guides them? And that's why the radio is so important, because it provides practical, useful, and necessary advice to children on a day-to-day basis. And because Free Play Lifeline radios don't require batteries or electricity, they can listen from morning till night. And they do. The radio? Your radio. Bring it here, please.
Pearson has given away thousands of these foot-high radios to refugees, poor mothers, and ex-soldiers throughout Africa. However, in Rwanda, the charity focuses on orphans. The Lifeline radio gives listeners increased access to life-saving information. That's a common element of programming here. For instance, there's instruction on how to properly install a mosquito net to avoid malaria, and there's information on HIV prevention. The children fiddle with their new radios. They stop on music, huddle in a group, and dance self-consciously. Since getting involved with the Free Play Foundation, there have been many moments for Pearson that have brought tears to her eyes and a lump to her throat. A day earlier, some orphan girls who had been raped told her they wouldn't give up their Lifeline radio for anything.
How's your radio? Can I come?
Pearson makes a visit to a 14-year-old orphan named Junta. A year and a half ago, she gave him a Lifeline radio. She asks him how it's changed his life. Before the radio, he used to be isolated here, but now friends come over to listen to the radio, so it helps him. He's not alone and lonely. It's a response Pearson's heard before.
They tell me it gives them hope, it gives them ideas, it helps ease isolation. They're interested in the world around them, they're interested in the countries around them. And it literally does change their lives. Can you tell me the things that you've learned from playing your Free Play radio, from listening to the news?
He didn't know the president of the BAD. Now he knows.
The president of?
This one for World Bank.
World Bank. Yeah. Oh, he now knows the president of the World Bank. That's wonderful. He knows the president of the World Bank.
Yeah.
Pearson's goal is to get a Lifeline radio out to as many children as possible in Africa so they can listen, learn, and even laugh simply by putting their radio out in the sun or winding it up.
Radio Rwanda.
Our report from Rwanda was produced by Sonia Varma for World Vision Radio. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. It's here and now.
If nobody understands, it matters not. I'm ready to die now. Darkness settles over Jonestown on its last day on Earth.
Those words were scribbled by an anonymous member of the People's Temple in Jonestown, Guyana, in November 1978. In the moments that followed, more than 900 disciples of the Reverend Jim Jones were dead after drinking cyanide-laced grape Kool-Aid. Stanley Nelson pieced together the harrowing footage of that day with the present-day testimony of more than 40 survivors of the cult for his new film, Jonestown, The Life and Death of the People's Temple. Nelson follows the rise of Jim Jones, an outcast white Midwestern child who becomes preacher at a mixed-race Indiana church, a champion of social justice after moving his flock to San Francisco, and eventually megalomaniac and sexual predator who commands his followers to die. And Stanley Nelson joins us now to speak about Jonestown. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Well, also joining us is Hugh Forsten. Stanley, you know Hugh well. He's a former member of the People's Temple, now a pastor in Los Angeles and a participant in the film. Hugh, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Hugh, I've got to start with you. This was so difficult to watch. You know, a lot of people just don't understand how anyone could have joined this group. Does this give you an opportunity to help, you know, set the record on what happened?
Yeah, it gives people a better insight that we all weren't crazy. We believed in an ideal, at least the ideal that was laid before us previous to that, but the plan wasn't to end up in this way, even though it did.
Stanley, at one point you put together a montage of, you know, people now trying to remember what their rationalizations were for staying, even when they were hearing some of these things. Let's listen.
It's kind of like when you get married and you have this ideal and you're in love, and then, you know, the honeymoon wears off and reality sets in. And most people, once the going gets rough, don't jump out immediately.
I have a conscious memory of sitting there thinking to myself, this is wrong. And I didn't do a damn thing to stand up and say, this is wrong.
Well, Stanley, let's talk about, how it might have happened. I mean, you track the story for us.
I think that one of the things you have to understand People's Temple at all is that for so long, Jim Jones delivered on his promise to people.
Right.
You know, he promised people, you know, come in and I'll take care of you, you know, to the old folks. He promised the young folks, come in, you know, and you can be part of a community and you can be part of something bigger than yourself, part of something that's changing the world. And people saw that and latched on to it.
Then a reporter wrote a damning story based on people who came forward from the group and talked about the sexual abuse and other abuse and the fact that nobody could talk to each other and what was increasing paranoia on Jim Jones' part. Almost overnight, he moved almost 900 people 300 miles into the woods of Guyana. I want to play a little clip. Here's Mike Touche. Is that how he pronounces it, Mike Touche?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Broadcasting a message back to the devotees who are still in the U.S. He's one of the survivors who appears in the film also as a commentator. Here he is as a young man when he's first moved to Guyana.
Hello, family. It's such a joy and great pleasure being here because of Father's love. We are trying to make, and we are making, a place of refuge for all of you here. I do not want to go back in any way, shape, or form to the States. I love it here, and this is the place where all of you are going to be.
Hugh, you were there as well.
Yeah.
How much family did you have there?
My first wife and my three-year-old son.
And how would you describe Guyana?
It was actually a beautiful place when you think about it, because of the fact that it was right in the middle of the jungle. It had been carved out. We had carved it out. But it could have been a striving little society.
And the love between people who lived there, it seems that, things, when they started to fall apart, did so quickly. California Congressman Leo Ryan came with an entourage of aides and reporters and some television cameramen to see for themselves what people back in San Francisco had been accusing the group of. Stanley, as you see the film, how quickly did it just fall apart?
Well, that's one of the most amazing things about the last couple of days of Jonestown, the first night they're there, you know, they put on a huge celebration for Ryan and his entourage. And, you know, they have a full band with a horn section, and they're singing Earth, Wind, and Fire songs. Mm-hmm. And the people are dancing and happy. And the next day, 24 hours later, they're all dead. So it happened, you know, just in an incredible escalation in this 24-hour period. And for a large part of that time, you know, the NBC crew is filming. They're actually filming when the first person comes up to Congressman Ryan and says they want to go. And there's arguments about who can leave and who can't. And it's just this incredible footage.
People say they do want to go. The congressman says he will take them. Someone tries to stab the congressman. They race back to the plane, and then at the plane, gunmen pull up and mow many of the people down at the plane, and then back at Jonestown, Jim Jones begins the suicide. Let's listen just a little of that.
Die with respect. Die with a degree of dignity. It's nothing to get, it's just stepping over in another plane. Don't be this way. The infamous suicide was in an act of revolutionary suicide protesting the conditions of an inhumane world. Mother, please. Mother, please, don't do this. Put down your life with your child, but don't do this.
Hugh, I can't stand listening to that sound, and I can't imagine what it's like for you, because your wife and child were there and took that Kool-Aid. Mm-hmm. We should point out, Stanley, you remind us that, yes, some of them just quickly took the Kool-Aid, but there were men with guns standing on the perimeter.
Yeah, the question, you know, of whether it was suicide or not, you know, is one that kind of reverberates, you know. There were 250 people there who were under 18. They were minors, you know. I mean, certainly they were murdered. There were guards there with guns and bows and arrows and crossbows. And Jim Jones said, you know, if you don't take the Kool-Aid, then you're going to die by the gun. And, you know, he also, you know, systematically misinformed people and told them that the army was coming down to get them, that they were going to take away their children, that, you know, this was the end for them. So, you know, if suicide is making, you know, kind of an informed decision to end your life,
right.
then certainly, you know, this wasn't suicide.
And those children.
And then on the other hand, what he did, too, he had often mentioned this, well, if we ever have to do a revolutionary suicide, as he called it, then don't worry about it. I could resurrect everybody in the morning.
People believed him?
Yes. 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 Some people believed him. They believed that he had that much power, that he could do that.
Hugh, do you hate Jim Jones?
No. I've gotten past that. I had to take some of the blame because I allowed him to make decisions for my life.
Hugh Forston, former member of the People's Temple, now a pastor in Los Angeles. Stanley Nelson, director of the new documentary Jonestown, The Life and Death of the People's Temple. And by the way, for information on where you can see the film, go to our website, here-now.org. I want to thank you both. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
All right.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next